Welcome to another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my co-host and friend, Jed Hartley, son of a false prophet and former member of the International House of Prayer. Jed, I've been wondering something, and I don't know if this may spawn off into a topic, it may not, but I've been listening to things that you've been telling me, things that Brantley's been telling me. I've had comments galore coming in off of all of the recent news with Bethel and just all of these different ministries. And I watch as a leader falls, it's like dominoes. One falls, then another, then another, then another. But in the game of dominoes, whenever you push the little domino and they all begin to fall down, they don't just stand right back up. Yeah. And in this movement, sadly, what happens is these dominoes will fall and then they'll get right back up. And the word reform is sometimes used. Sometimes they just stand up and they don't care. But in some cases, they say, we're going to reform, we're going to change things. And the thought, you know, I've been toying around with the idea of what reform looks like for a decade now, but I wanted to ask you what reform looks like, because in my opinion, reform for somebody who, I've used this example before, I hate to run it into the ground, but reform for a school teacher that I just suddenly learned is teaching my children, and they happen to be an ex-convict with all kinds of very horrific crimes, and then suddenly they commit another crime. Well, for me, reform for this is they should never be in around children again. That's just something that you don't do. But in the Christian ministry, it's this weird thing, because as a Christian, you believe in forgiveness. You believe God does forgive. So there has to be some sort of a Christian reform. That part I agree with. But what does reform actually look like? And again, I've toyed around with this thought for decades, almost a decade now since I've been doing my research. What would reform look like if a minister who was in a movement by a false prophet, for example, were to say, I'm sorry, I did not know this was a false prophet. I just suddenly learned every prophecy this guy had was fake, and I want to reform. How does he keep his church? Because I actually know ministers that have done this, and I've watched their churches implode. So you've got this complex question. What does reform look like for an apostle, for a prophet, for a minister? And then what does it look like for the congregation? How should they accept reform? And I don't know that we can even answer this, but I want to try.
I think it's a really good question. And I you know, to some extent, we're not going to be the ones answering it in a causal way. That, you know, I doubt the Bethel board is going to be watching this video and being like, oh, okay, let's take these points. But a lot of people within the Bethel community and the IHOP community and the X, people who were once in those communities, obviously do listen, and that's where I'm coming from. And so I think that you made a really good distinction, because there's the reform of the pastors or the leaders who have fallen, and then there's the reform of the church or congregation. And I think that those are two very separate things. And my quick analysis is that the reformation of the pastors and the leaders, when we're talking about on the level of Mike Bickle, Bob Hartley, Bob Jones, Paul Kane, Sean Bowles, Chris Reed, all these individuals who have fallen because of rampant deception, rampant prophetic abuse, I will say very clearly, there is not reformation for these people within the context of being put back into leadership. There just isn't. There's no positive way that can happen. I mean, I'm not saying that it won't happen where people will attempt to make this happen, but there is no healthy way in which these people can ever be restored to leaders of ministry, just flat out. And that's like I know that some people might think that that's a little harsh of a statement, I have seen it way too many times. Also, like just the way that you said it too, if there's someone who is involved with child abuse, the UK, they can go and get if they go to prison. Like I've been a part of like both. I taught philosophy at a prison a class at Leavenworth Prison in Kansas. I was part of like prison ministries when I was younger, and we would speak. And the whole idea was that the person themselves can be reformed and they can change. And I've seen dramatic transformations of people. But yes, still, if there someone was involved with child abuse, you don't then put them in a position where they're leading children again. Like that's just that. That path has been closed off for them, and that I think that that's like a very concrete, clear thing that we can do as a society that makes sense. Like, there's just no, regardless of whether you believe in the power of reform and people being able to change their ways, it is good practice to not let those who have abused individuals be back in systems in which they can abuse again. And that is exactly what we're having with the, that's exactly the discussion with these pastors. Like, you know, it's the same thing as like my, if someone has alcohol addiction, you don't, they don't go and become a bartender right after, you know, get, right after rehab. That you don't put them in a position in which the abuses is readily and available for them. And I think specifically, even more so with this community of leaders, I want to be even more so. Even more so than the people who go to prison for abuse and then come back out. Like, there's actual penance that have been paid. There is change. Like, there's structural things. There's consequences that people have encountered that cause a sort of reformation or cause, like, the need for change in someone's life. I have seen that with people who have gone to prison through these different like ministries and like the teaching thing that I did. I've seen and talked with people about that sort of how that was going to prison, going encountering the consequences of their actions was a wake-up call to them in their life of how their system, their way of operating, whether it was a single instance of a bad decision that you know horrifically hurt someone or something like that, or whether it was long and more systematic, many decisions of poor decisions, like there was this sort of impetus to change and recognize this is something that I'm capable of doing. How can I change who I am so that I don't do this again? I have not once seen that with the reformation of these pastors. I mean, Bob Jones, when he fell and he was confronted, I know the people who were on the Bob Jones rehabilitation team because there were two of them were related to me. One was my uncle and one was my dad. And I heard them talk about the way that Reformation rehabilitation went and how it was 3 years and how the story got changed and recontextualized. And I was just talking with my cousin not too long ago, and he grew up hearing some of the same stories I did. And I'm not even going to go into detail of it, but we both were reminiscing about how the Bob Jones story, where he had abused two women, and used prophecy to get them to undress and then sexually abuse them, how that was, we were never told the story in those terms, how it was always, in fact, many times it was the women who were painted as the aggressors, and he was the poor victim. Or one of the things that my cousin said, and my cousin's a little older than me, and so he had heard and experienced more of these stories, but he remembers it being Bob Jones had had a prophecy that if he ever stepped out of line, sexually, that the Lord would kill him. That he had gotten prophecies from the Lord that, you know, he would strike him down dead. And so the idea is that Bob Jones did this act because he was self-destructing and he wanted the Lord to kill him. This is the story that my cousin was told. So the way that this was repainted was sort of like a moment. It had nothing really to do with sexual abuse or exploitation. It was this sort of low point in Bob Jones' life where he was doing something that he knew was forbidden by God because he was suicidal or didn't want to continue on. And by the fact that God did not strike him down, it sort of reaffirmed that God is like still wanting him to do good things on this earth. And there was a whole story too about how Bob Jones had died and gone to hell and resurrected. And so this was not the first time that this sort of rhetoric was being used with the Bob Jones story of like, God has put him on this earth. So even his testimony of how he abused someone was filtered and used as a testimony to reaffirm his sort of anointing by God. So all this to say, these men who go through these processes of rehabilitation and restoration are, from my eyes, never repented, never actually understand what they do, how horrific it is, how destructive it is, never once really actually come to terms with it publicly. And in doing so, when they are then restored to ministry, they're just going to have the same type of ministry that they had before. They're just going to be more careful, and maybe they won't actually, because they kind of got away with it. So what is the actual impetus for them to change if, you know, they get a 2-year sabbatical and come back to doing the same thing they did? Jimmy Baker, I think, is a good example of this, where there was this huge scandal that happened in I think it was the 90s. And I mean, really horrific scandal. And you see him now, he's had a career for 40, 50 years since then, where he is selling COVID miracle curing drugs on his website, talking about the end times and prophesying. I mean, he's just doing the same deceptive techniques that he did when he was young. There isn't actually any change.
I'm a person who believes that people can change, and they can change for the good. Even the worst cases that, if you read through the Royce report, there are some very horrific individuals out there. I think even the worst of the worst can change for the better. Does that mean that I think they should be back in the ministry when they do? I don't think so. I think that's not even a point that should be argued.
Yeah.
The question comes for me, it's more to the point of, you're in a movement that really enables these predators. You're in a movement that enables harm. And like you just gave a perfect example. So yes, they don't cause harm in the one particular area, but then they go and they do the COVID thing, or there's all kinds of different gimmicks and scams. And so you take a person who's got a problem, maybe they did rehabilitate, maybe they didn't, but then that type of mentality, they continue on to other problems. And that's just not a person who's really fit for the ministry. And I think that's the key phrase. In this movement, there is no term fit for the ministry that really applies. Fit for the ministry is a temporary thing in this type of movement. And in many other denominations, it's one strike, you're out. You can't do this, man. You can't do this to people and then expect we're going to put you back in a platform. Now, you can still be a Christian. You can still come attend a service. But the problem is, reform for me isn't about the person. It's about the framework that allowed that person to do what they did. Usually, in this type of movement, that framework was hero worship. Because they're a hero, our movement can't survive without this person. So they may fall for a period of time, but we've got to lift them back up, or we don't have a movement. And when you think of it like that, there is no way not to think of it as a cult, because it is a it is centered around a human being. So the question becomes for me, and this this may be a question for another podcast, reform for me, you almost have to take into consideration the cult aspect. If this group can reform, can they reform without the leader?
You totally anticipated where I was going with this too, because I think that the you cannot have the reformation of both the leader and the ministry, because the ministry and leader were led in a, such a way that abuse happened. And so, you know, it's like you can't have that vehicle be being driven by that same driver again, because it'll inevitably be driven back to the same place. It'll still do the same things. And so then there's this question of, well, what about the, what about Bethel Church? What about IHOP? What about Morningstar? If we remove the abusive people who are in leadership of those communities, let's use IHOP because it's there has been an abusive leader who has been removed from that ministry quite presently. For the International House of Prayer, is there such thing as reformation for the International House of Prayer? Now, I think I've said this in previous episodes, and I will say it clear here. I don't think that there is. In fact, I will state quite confidently, IHOP is not at the place because it cannot be separated from Mike Bickle. And not just Mike Bickle, but Bob Jones and the other sort of abusers who built that system. You can see it now, and we've talked about this too, of they are trying to extract the name of Mike Bickle while carrying the legacy of Mike Bickle within their identity. And they, the, it's super weird, super creepy, but all of their rhetoric on their websites and what they're saying from the pulpit is a mixture of, hey, don't, to the congregation, don't look online, like let's avoid even thinking about this. The right after the scandal broke with Mike Bickle, this was back in 2023, the first message that they had Chris Reed come to their Sunday service. And Chris Reed, I remember seeing this live, like I watched it live. Chris Reed spoke a message about Lot's wife and the idea of don't turn your head, don't look to the past. And there was a lot of like misogynist rhetoric too about this woman who looked back, and he hit it really hard where it was like, don't listen to the women who are looking back, stay forward. Otherwise God will turn you into a pillar of salt. And it was, sometimes I actually appreciate some of these ministers being so explicit about what they believe, because, I mean, it's a perfect encapsulation of what the rhetoric is. So like, I couldn't have come up with a better metaphor. Like they truly are saying, do not look at things. Do not turn around. Do not evaluate what went wrong at IHOP or what went wrong with Mike Bickle. God is saying so. And if you do, you'll be turned into a pillar of salt. Like it's so clear and specific. And then Chris Reed in that same year gets exposed for his own sexual scandal and how he was very similarly, perhaps not to the scale of Mike Bickle, but he had a student who he was a pastor over and a teacher over, who he was having an affair with and was manipulating through his position as a minister. So surprise, surprise, the man who's saying don't look back also has skeletons in his closet right behind him. So the rhetoric of IHOP has been this: don't look back, don't look online, don't you dare listen to people like John Collins. Of course not. Like, can't be hearing anything from the outside world. And then they rebranded what the history of IHOP was. So they were like, don't look back. Here, we'll tell you what happened. And they have this new history of IHOP written on their webpage that talks about how a ragtag bunch of people decided to get together one day, as if it was something that wasn't years and years of planning, and as if it wasn't like a mega church that was sponsoring the entire inception of the International House of Prayer. But anyway, they rewrite their narrative, and then in every paragraph they talk about prophecies, and they talk about they use prophetic language that was straight from the mouth of Mike Bickle and Bob Jones. And so those prophecies still are interwoven into the fabric of the church's identity. So if there's a question of, can this ministry reform without these abusive leaders? It clearly is no. Like, that's, IHOP clearly is not going to do it. If it was to happen, I'm not saying that there couldn't be some, you know, 24-hour house of prayer type ministry that couldn't be good and healthy. I mean, I think that there's problems with anything that arises in this sort of community, but I think that there is sort of a spectrum of healthy, and I think that there could be a sort of healthy ish version of the IHOP model insofar as the 24-hour house of prayer, where people, I think I made this joke before on this podcast, but it's not really a joke. If IHOP was more like the pancake place than the prayer room place, it would be actually a pretty good place where people could come and get spiritually fed 24 hours a day, and like that have a place where, you know, people are safe, a sort of sanctuary. I think that makes sense, and I understand why people like that idea, but that's not what IHOP is, and it clearly isn't, because they are the tendrils of Mike Bickle and Bob Jones and others are still clearly throughout the rhetoric and system itself, and they expect people not to notice because they maintain such a level of control over their congregants. And when they don't have control over their congregants, they excommunicate them. And that's just so this is all cult stuff. And so can you reform a cult? No, you can not like this, because it is built. I think that I love what you're saying, the distinction about hero worship. Like, they are still deifying their heroes. They still have this, the words and the message and the vision of the abusive founders are still the heartbeat of the organization. And while that person's face is no longer being deified in the way that it was, which also means, like, I think they're going to lose numbers, because cults need so until someone else comes up and supplants that position, and it becomes a new pseudo Mike Bickle, or until Mike Bickle comes back, because let's face it, that is absolutely within the realm of possibility. I mean, IHOP's going to be kind of struggling to build its congregation, but I the whole thing needs to be torn down and abolished 100%. And I think that 90% of people who were within that ministry from over the past few decades would probably agree with that. Maybe not 90%, but certainly I would say certainly more than 50%. I think that the majority of people who have come from the International House of Prayer, who not just like visited, but who are actually on staff there or part of it, recognize that, oh, this is horrific. I will say easily 90% of the children who grew up in that community are like, yeah, get rid of this.
Reform for me is really, it comes down to a reform of the culture. It took me a long time, many years actually, to come to terms with the fact that the culture we were in wasn't really quite Christian, but yet it used the phrase Christianity and used the name Jesus. So a Christian, their mythology is the mythology of Jesus Christ. And I'm using the word mythology. I know it's going to offend the crowd, but understand what I'm trying to say here. There is a mythology that surrounds a God if you're worshiping a God. In Christianity, you believe that mythology to be true. So in mythology, Christianity is the life stories, the events in the life of Jesus, the things that you can read in the Bible, and that's why we have a Bible, so that you can read more about Jesus. You can understand what the Christians believe as their mythology, which again, Christians believe it to be true. That can be said of every ancient religion. If you wanted to study the mythology of Zeus, the followers of Zeus believed it to be true. That's how you worship a deity. Now take the culture that has been created by this movement, long before IHOP KC. Branhamism, we had the same thing. Go back in time, Taoism had the same thing. Go before him, almost as far back as you can go in history. You're going to find somebody who has created a mythology, calling it Christian, but the mythology was about themselves or the people working with them. So in Branhamism, we had what we called the life stories. And this would be what in IHOP KC you called your prophetic history. In the life stories, it's talking about how all of this came together, how the movement began, the spiritual experiences of Branham, the prophecies, etc. Every single destructive cult that I've looked at, they have something similar. What is it? It's their mythology. And that mythology is not focused on Jesus. It's focused on the individual. But it's very tricky because in the Christian cults, they focus their mythology on the individual who is a intermediator. Basically, here's the experience that taught us about Jesus, and therefore we know Jesus. So it's like going through this person. When you do this and you form a group, like I said earlier, if you take that person away, what's left? Why would you not just go to a normal denominational church? Why would you not go to any church? I don't need this person, then why am I here? It's basically the question, right? So it really comes down to a reform as a reform of the culture. If your religion requires the person or persons who are on this platform to be there, then your religion really isn't Christianity. It's Bickleanity, it's Branhamanity, it is not Christianity. So for me, reform looks like that, but take it a step further. This is where it gets really odd for me, and I can't really put into words. I would have to do some deep studies into the government, the laws that are surrounding this. But in most churches, the churches are owned by the people. And if you go out into the middle of the country and you find this little church with the little steeple on the hill, and you go and walk into that church, it will have a pastor, and the pastor may have been there for all his life, but it's still owned by the people. And if the people were to all vote and say, we don't want that guy, kick him out, then they would vote in a new person, and the new person would take over the church. No harm done. The minister who was kicked out may actually attend that church, and I think I have seen that happen a few times. So what happens is the church is owned by the people. The people are the ones who are governing what's happening on the platform, right? They all want Jesus. They want a teacher that's teaching Jesus, and they're the bottom. They're the end-all, say-all as it relates to the church. But in the modern ministries that we're talking about, whenever a leadership has a problem, they go get a third party to come evaluate, right? Not even the people who are saying, wait, we have a problem. They go outside of this and they bring in a third party to investigate. The third party collaborates with the very ministry that's trying to stay in power. And so you have this unusual collaboration that isn't really... it isn't really owned and governed by the people. And so the question comes down to the documentation of the church. Do the people really own the church? Probably not. Otherwise, that would have never happened. The outside party would be working with the congregation, not with the leadership. So you've got this weird thing where the culture is the problem. The mythology empowers the leader. The church is no longer owned by the people, so they don't have any decision. And the accountability is just, it has completely disappeared.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started? Or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the new apostolic reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support.
I think that the question, like, okay, so who leads the body? Is it the head or the body itself? Like, who is directing the movement of the organization? And I think that we're getting at some of the fundamental structural issues that undermine genuine reformation of these communities. Because, I mean, this just goes back to some of the major pitfalls of new apostolic reformation churches. They are not a part of a larger congregation. So you can't have sort of denominational, you can't have someone from a different church community, but in the same denomination, come and look and bring a sense of accountability there, because they're all non-denominational independent churches, and they're structured that way, that they are all kings of their little castles, which that's, I've used that metaphor before, and I think it's very apt, because they really are like structured as little kingdoms, and all of these different little rulers of their kingdoms are very much beholden only to themselves. So there's that structural issue. There's the doctrinal structural issue of where is the sort of longer discipline of the faith that they come out of. Like you were talking about, their doctrine really is Mike Bickle doctrine, it's William Branham doctrine, it's Bob Jones, Bill Johnson doctrine. Like, these are not long sort of traditions of like, okay, we come from a Baptist community and this is the sort of historical precedent for the ways that this community has lived, and these are the tenets that we have held since, you know, 1885, when this church was first founded, or something like that. There isn't that sort of historical foothold. And even more so of that just not being the case, it's actually structured in a way in which there is never going to be a historical foothold of these types of churches, unless, of course, they change the very structure of the church. But like, Bethel is not going to have a core doctrine ever, because it is malleable. It is based off of who the charismatic leader is that is their leader at the time, whether it's Bill Johnson or Bill Johnson stepping down. And is it going to be Chris Ballatin? Is it going to be, you know, who else? What is it going to sort of absorb around. I mean, Bethel's doctrine is fuzzy at best. If you go there, there's a lot of people who are very critical of Bethel simply because, like, there's a lot of New Age rhetoric and weird. I mean, Betty Johnson herself was a huge proponent of a lot of, like, New Age Christian healings with crystals and with frequencies and vibrations and stuff like that. And so, you know, maybe that won't be a thing in 10 years. Maybe that will be more of a thing in 10 years. It's not structured in a way that there actually needs to be this, like, hey, when you come here, you know what you're getting. No, it very much is like, well, we're gonna move where the spirit leads us. I mean, quite literally, that's the doctrine that they have. And IHOP was a similar way. They shrouded it in this air of arrogancy and of intellectualism, which this always boils my blood whenever I think back to, like, I was a young thinker trying to ask questions and trying to ascertain the logic of the system that I'm growing up in, and, like, quite genuinely trying to do so that I can contribute and be a part of this system, and was constantly belittled and demeaned by people who were in teacher leadership there, because this was both at during my high school, and we would take college classes at IHOPU. Dave Slyker is one of the individuals who would do this. I remember how he would teach and just bully young thinkers because they would ask questions. And it wasn't questions like, if I'm teaching a math class, which I do, that's my job. And one of the students is like, you know, Mr. Hartley, I don't understand the quadratic formula because, like, I don't understand where it came from and where, you know, am I going to belittle them? Am I going to talk down to them? Am I going to be impatient with them because they don't understand what I'm talking about? No, I'm going to talk about squaring the root and going to talk about where it came from. And I'm going to try my best to explain it to them. And I'm going to be empathetic and be like, yeah, it's confusing. And a lot of people, you know, this was a miracle when it was first invented. And so, like, you know, respect their process as, like, a young thinker and young learner. And not only was this just, like, arrogance and Dave Slyker being a bad teacher, it was structurally so that he needed to be, because there was not any scaffolding. There isn't a teach them how to complete the square to derive the formula, because there is no derivation of the formula, because these men were not as smart as they were pretending to be, and were not as enlightened, and were not some transcendent thinkers who had been touched by God, who bridged the gaps that us mortal individuals could not also bridge the gap. They just had beliefs that were totally inconsistent, and they used bullying as a method of training their young individuals to not ask questions about the scaffolding of their very belief system. So the only people who rose to power were the ones who were not curious, the ones who didn't ask questions about this, didn't really care about the scaffolding for it, because it doesn't work. It's built on quicksand. Like, it is going to shift and it's going to fall, and then they'll just build up a new, you know, version, which is exactly what IHOP did. It's like, you see the tearing down of the legacy of IHOP, and they're like, well, let's just rewrite it and tell people it was this, and then tell them if they turn around and look back, they'll turn into salt. It's just such a, it's such an abusive, feeble tactic. So clearly seen as devious and as underhanded. But yet it works, because as long as there are impressionable young adults to manipulate, it will continue to feed on them and whatnot. So when we talk about the structure that for Reformation, I mean, you really got to talk about, like, you got to start from the beginning. You got to build it from the ground up. And with something like IHOP, it's like, you, if you look at it as a building and the entire foundation is rotten, not just rotten, like there's mold and actual safety hazard stuff. It's like, okay, well, the land that we built on might be able to be salvaged, but the structure itself has to be demolished. Like, there's no put a new paint job, maybe put in some more support beams and call it square. It's, we have to bulldoze and we have to rebuild from the ground up. And I think the question then, and where I would kind of want to turn and be like, well, let's talk about the land that we build on. And this is where I probably diverge from even some of the listeners here. Because, like, I appreciate the people who were a part of these organizations. Not necessarily that I agree with them or that it's a good expression of Christianity, but, like, I genuinely believe that at IHOP, at Bethel, especially at YWAM, I feel there was a higher concentration of people who were wanting to do good on earth, and who were willing to sacrifice their own safety, their own wealth, their own security in order to better the world. Whether that looked like volunteering in more humanitarian causes, oftentimes it was is less that and more evangelical, like evangelizing in nature and proselytizing in nature. But at the heart of it, I do think that there are a lot of people who want to have a sort of mystical Christian doctrine and be a part of a sort of experience in which they are trying their best to bring heaven on earth in a way that I don't think is as nearly as insidious and dominionistic as, like, the leadership is, but in a genuine sense of, like, I want to leave this place better than I found it. I want to have peace, kindness, love, empathy, joy. I want to spread that to the people around me, and I want to dedicate my life to the pursuit of doing that. And this is why, like, the conversation about reformation and restoration of these churches, I think, is more complicated than just blow it all up and get rid of all of these things. Because I do think that there's the question of, there are these genuine people, and is there any genuine expression to this sort of type of thing that they gravitate to it? Or is it all hero worship? And I honestly don't know. I would love to hear what you think, John, about that. But, like, is there a version of Bethel that maybe isn't perfect? Well, it certainly is not perfect. I won't even make that the standard, but is healthier.
You mentioned the word bullying, and I'm getting to your question, but you mentioned the word bullying, and I got to thinking, it's not just the bullying, it's also the mind control elements somewhat support it, which is how I want to head towards the Bethel question. Yeah. So there's this problem of loaded language. I had a conversation recently with a person. They were talking about, you can almost spot a person who's in this type of movement just simply by the phrases they use. One of the phrases is, for a season. I started laughing so hard because I can just put faces to that. People who say, we had a really, really hard time for a season. And it's usually just those people who are indoctrinated in this type of movement that say these things. But and that's not problematic at all. That's just a phrase people use. But now take that phrase and apply it to the leadership. I'm in Bethel, and we have this leadership for a season. And then something happened, and then the season changed. So people are mentally taking passages of time, decades of time, and saying that was season one. This horrific thing happened because of the leadership. And then it happens again because it's a different season, and the season has been, the season has changed basically. So you've got this indoctrinated mentality that, yes, this terrible, terrible thing happened, but that was spring. Now it is fall, so we're changing seasons, but we're going to keep the same leadership. And so where you end up with is, the bottom line for me is this, whenever they use the word reform in any of these statements that they issue, etc., my mind doesn't actually read that word. What I read instead is, we're going to rebrand because our branding was for the spring. Now we're branding for another season. It's the fall. And yes, we had all of these leaders who fell. And so we're going to rebrand with a new season. And we're going to completely distract you with our new branding so that you don't think about that season that came before. And it really all comes down to the indoctrination, because if it, again, if it was one of these normal churches where the people are the ones who make the decisions, the body of the church, the congregation, the one who pays for the lights to come on the building, they would say, no, you're not going to rebrand. You're not going to keep the same people. These people are a problem, and they enabled these other people to be a problem. We want all those people out. If the church could do this, then it would be a healthy church, and the church would be able to, they would be, So let's change it a bit. What if they did this? What if they rebranded, called it reformed, but instead we're going to rebrand and we're going to change it so that we want everybody in this seat to critically think. We want everybody in this seat who, if you're out in the audience, we want you to hold us accountable. And if we're not, we want you to vote us out and get somebody else who's in here. If we have some sort of a scandal, we want you to be the ones who contact the third parties, and you make the decisions whether we stay or not. What if that was the rebranding? What would happen in churches like these?
You'd be changing the actual bones of the church for them, because that's see, this is the thing. That's not what they think is the problem. They don't think that it's that level of accountability of like, hey, if we're not thinking critically, even like if we're just at the place of being like, well, let's think, I want everybody in here to think critically. Like that is not Bethel's MO. And the term of rebranding, I mean, I think that's a very apt way of saying it. It being a measure of like, not a season of restoration, a season of rebranding. That's really what a lot of these are. And you sticking with the, you know, house metaphor, there are foundational issues that are the problem in all of these churches, not just IHOP, but Bethel, Morningstar. I mean, they're not all the same foundational issues, but many of them are very similar. And it isn't just that the leader of the organization was sexually abusing young women. Like that is part of the symptoms of what was going on at IHOP, but that is not the structural foundational issue at International House of Prayer. And at Bethel, same thing. They're foundational issues. Any restoration, any voting, they vote out Bill Johnson and Chris Vallotton. I'm getting a little distracted here, but like that recently Chris Vallotton and Bill Johnson released a video where they apologized for the handling of the Shambola situation, which I know I'm diverging thoughts here, but I'll get back to it. But just to talk about that for a second. So for people who haven't seen the video, there was a very genuine apology that both Bill and Chris gave. And I don't think that it was performatively genuine. Like, I genuinely think that I really appreciated the tone of their apology and the content of their apology. In some respects, there are some big issues, but basically Chris and Bill got up there and said, we messed up. We betrayed our congregation. We elevated someone who was not safe, and then we did not warn the congregation when we knew that he was not safe. And Chris was like, I've had a recent change of heart about this, and seemed like he had kind of seen the light of being recognizing, oh my goodness, I really messed up here. It was really hard. I don't think John, you and I have talked about this. Did you see that video, John?
I did.
Yeah. So, you know, you tell me what you think and whether or not you felt like it was genuine or not. But, I mean, to me, it came across as very genuine, which made it all the worse for me in some respects, because, they have not taken that stance with my father. And my father is like a very parallel situation with Shambles, like almost identical in some respects. I don't understand how they can see the light with Shambles and not see the light with Bob Hartley. And it might just have to do with the fact that there was a Michael Winger video that was 6 hours long that was way more in detail about Shambles. There was also one about my dad too, but like, I think that there was a lot of pressure on Chris and Bill to say something about Shambles. So I'd be fascinated to know what their philosophy is on why they haven't reached out to me or haven't spoken publicly about my dad. Because if they had taken the same tone, so this is why it was hard for me to see. They are apologizing and they are saying many of the same things. Like, I had a phone call with Chris Vallotton right before I sort of publicly exposed my father for the things that he was doing and put pressure on Bethel. Or maybe it was right after I had started doing that. But I had a phone call with Chris Vallotton, and he gave me this line of like, we understand that your dad's doing these bad things, but like, what are we to do about it? He's not our, he doesn't work for us. It goes back to that sort of independent ministry. Like, he's an itinerant minister. Like, he does his own thing. We're not on his board. We don't get to tell him what to do. And I was very clearly like, you gave him the platform that he has. You are the reason why people are coming to his house so that he can have these prophetic meetings, especially in Bethel. Like, he had some prestige outside of Bethel, but especially in Reading. Like, when he was living in Reading, he was holding Bible studies. And if he was not a famous person at Bethel Church, there wouldn't be people showing up at his door, but they were showing up in droves. And so, I mean, Bethel was the reason that my dad got such a grand level of prestige. And I told that very clearly and saliently to Chris Vallotton, and just nothing like from him. He didn't agree. And he was like, your dad's going to do whatever he wants. We can't control him. And so that led me to having to speak out publicly, because I felt like they weren't going to do anything. So I, my father's son, I had to get online and talk about the sins of my father and how my father was a dangerous man, and how that people of the Reading community and the Bethel community and the IOP community need to not go to his Bible studies and need to, you know, be warned that he is actively preying on people. And like, that's, you know, I've come to terms and come to peace with the fact that I did that and I had to do that. But like, had Chris Vallotton understood what I was talking to him back then, and he had come to see the light when I was even talking to him, I would have never had to like publicly talk about my dad. I would probably still have a modicum of relationship with my father. Like, I don't know if that would be a good thing, but my life has forever changed because these men were not able to come to terms with the reality of the world that they had built. And now I see a flash of them on stage recognizing, oh my goodness, we messed up. And Chris, there's a clip in the video where Chris almost identically uses the same language that I told to him. I don't know if it's coincidence. I don't know if he actually heard what I said, or I don't know. But he says, he kind of talks about with Sean Bowles. He was like, well, at first I was like, well, he's not our minister. And the same thing that he said about my dad, like we don't get to tell him what to do. And then Chris is like, but then I thought about it and we elevated him. We put him in the position. We gave him his mantle, or said something to that respect. And it was almost identical to what I had said about what they did with my dad. And it was comforting in one sense of like, yeah, that's exactly what I wanted Chris to come to terms with. And like, this is a good revelation that they're coming to terms with. But one, it's too little too late. Two, is it actually, are they understanding the actual scope of it? Because it's not just a Sean Bowles thing. It's almost worse. It's almost worse than if they had just been like, hey, don't look back. There's the pillar of salt. Like, you'll turn into it. It's better. It's better because at least they're recognizing the truth of what's going on. But like, is there going to be reformation? Are they going to actually then say, it's like they're looking at their scaffolding and seeing the rot, seeing the mold that is in their house. And they're like, wow, man, we messed up. Anyway, let's collect funds for our next, you know, like they literally had an offering right after this. So it's like, are they going to actually structurally change things to make it so prophets cannot just read off an iPad and manipulate people in their congregation? Are they going to make it so that if individuals commit sexual abuse, that there is a measure of like public accountability for these things? Are Chris and Bill going to step down? Is Bill Johnson going to say, hey, my inability to see the flaws of the people who I consider my friends makes me a really actually bad shepherd of a community, and so therefore I shouldn't protect the flock if I cannot see the sheep? Or sorry, if I cannot see the wolves, like, is he going to step down? Is Chris Fallotton going to recognize, like, okay, I messed up with Sean Bowles, but I also messed up with Bob Hartley. I also messed up with not speaking about Bob Jones. I also messed up with not speaking about Chris Reed. I also messed up by not speaking about all of these other individuals. Is there going to be actual structural movement? Or is it going to be just another rebrand?
I know we'll probably anger a lot of the people listening, but I see many of the leaders as victims of the system. And what I mean by that is they believe so much. I know some leadership who are maybe not to the same level as them, but are doing some of the same things. They really believe what it is they're preaching, and they believe that they are untouchable because it's a movement by God. The problem is, I strongly question the movement by God part, but when you're in that type of system, you make decisions that you think, God's going to shield me because it's a movement by God. How could God not let this movement continue? Therefore, I'll put these people in who don't really deserve to be in leadership positions, or I'll platform them in the ministry because God's going to protect everything. And then what happens is whenever they suddenly come to terms with the fact that God didn't really protect this and these were some pretty bad people, you find some, after it's too late, you find some strong repentance because they understand they messed up. They really messed up, some people. So what happens is the leadership are part of the system that is failing the leadership, and they're in this endless cycle up here at the top, not realizing that that cycle is spinning off 1,000 different cycles to the congregation. So the congregation gets stuck in the same cycles of seasons, if you want to call it a season. And the whole problem comes back down to the system has enabled this. The system is what needs to reform, not the ministry, not the ministers. The system needs to change. You can't allow people to do this. But I knew that you would have some opinions. I'm very glad I brought up this topic, and it's fascinating. I can think of probably 10 other similar topics that I want to get into. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's always great, John.
Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.